Welcome to the X-Men Task Podcast, the Batman years. My name is Willie Simpson.
My name is Sonya Rappaport.
Sonya, we're in the third season of Batman the Animated Series, the 14th episode entitled The Ultimate Thrill. This is a high-flying episode featuring a new Batman villain named Roxy Rocket, which sort of presents us with an unintentional theme this week, as we'll also be talking about the new Apple World War II series, Masters of the Air. But before we get to all that, first, let me dispense with the plugs. You can follow me on social media. Look up Willie Simpson. Join the X-Men Tasks podcast, Facebook, or Reddit groups. And join the community. Join the conversation. And last but not least, if you enjoy the show, please leave us a nice five-star review on iTunes. Again, we appreciate everyone who does just that. Sonya, as mentioned, we did check out the first new episode of the Tom Hanks, Steven Spielberg-produced Masters of the Air, the continuation of the Band Brothers series of miniseries that they've been doing since, the late 90s, early 2000s. Mm-hmm. The first was Band of Brothers, then The Pacific, and now Masters of the Air. A lavish production costing anywhere from $250 million to $300 million. The latest and greatest in World War II myth-making, Hollywood myth-making cinematic extravaganzas. We've only seen the first episode. It stars the guy from Elvis, Austin Butler. Mm-hmm. In your opinion, one of the lesser of the modern Elvises.
He's good in this so far, in this first episode that we watched. Mm-hmm. He is a good actor. Just looking at him, I kept thinking, like, why did they make him Elvis? It doesn't make sense to me.
I mean, it is absurd to read that little story where he had to go to a dialogue coach to get rid of the Elvis accent that he picked up for the Elvis movie.
Mm. He just got so used to speaking that way that he couldn't, like, shake it.
That is just
interesting.
That is just an SNL sketch that probably,
like, waiting to be made.
Yeah. do a parody of the King's Speech or something, but for a guy desperately trying to stop
not
talking,
not sound like Elvis.
Yeah. Speaking of Elvis, we also watched the Priscilla movie, the Sofia Coppola Priscilla movie. You finally caught up with that.
Yeah, no dangerous air stunts in that one. So
no,
that's not in our theme, but it was a good movie.
Right, it was quite good. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about that. But Masters of the Air, I thought the first episode was incredible. Spielberg and Hanks know what they're doing with this World War II stuff. They feel the subject matter deeply.
Yeah, they're both very committed to, like, keeping that history alive,
right?
Which, you know, like, given modern times, is not a bad idea. I won't say more about that.
But. Yeah, you're right. And they assemble these great young casts, and they've got incredible production design. It's all, like, period accurate uniforms and outfits, and they probably film on location more or less in England somewhere. And they really bring you into, like, the granular, like, moment-by-moment horror of what it's like to actually be in a war.
Mm.
You know, like, it's not, like, a glamorized thing where, they sugarcoat the violence or the attitudes that the people had. They show, like, how terrible it is to be a pilot and to get your face blown off. Like, that was one scene in the first episode there.
Yeah.
Or to, like, get horribly burned or horribly frozen in certain instances when, like, if they're flying at such high altitudes. And
yeah, I mean, the combat scenes are horrific, but they also even show – they have some, like, tense moments leading up to those where they even show how just, like, being in that situation, like, not even facing enemies yet, can be super dangerous. You know, you're, like, flying in an airplane 30,000 feet up and, like, you have equipment malfunction or you have to make, like, an emergency crash landing somewhere and it's, like, horrible weather. Right. And, like, the whole thing is just such a dangerous enterprise.
Yeah. I think so many people in general just share fears of falling out of the sky in an airplane. And then to literally go into combat in an airplane is like a level of, like, fear insanity that I think would crush most normal psyches, including my own. Like, I could never do that. Like, even just being a passenger on one of those... Like, you know, if I was, like, one, not a passenger, if I was one of the crew guys in the back doing the navigation or loading the machine guns, like, that would, I would not be able to, I would rather, if you gave me the choice, I'd rather be in the army.
Really?
Yeah, then I would want to be in one of those airplanes.
All of it is horrific.
Yeah, it's all horrible.
But the show, I mean.
Show's great.
The show does a good job of, like, painting a picture of what it was like. And so far, the acting has been really good.
I do have two nitpicks. Uh-huh. I'm sick of the Instagram filter. I mean, I know they've been doing that since Band of Brothers. They all have, like, this filter that makes it look like the past. You know, this, like, highly saturated colors usage.
I feel like they, like, lean towards blue tones. They, like, wash out the warmth in it,
yeah.
Which is the opposite of what a lot of productions do to try to make it feel like a different time.
Yeah.
You know, like a lot of times, like you look back on the past with warmer tones. This is the opposite, and it's almost like psychologically they want it to feel like colder. You know, like this is not like a warm, happy, feel-good kind of look back.
Right.
You know. Also, like the first Band of Brothers was made before like Instagram filters kind of thing. So you know.
Yeah, at the time it was,
Influenced by that.
Right. Yeah, but at the time that was, I think, a really cool choice. It made it look gritty. Mm. Band of Brothers made it. It brought like a greater level of realism to the undertaking. Because at that point, they're outside of, I guess, Saving Private Ryan, there hadn't really the level of realism that Spielberg was attempting to bring to these things. Like he kept upping the ante. But now it's like it's almost passé to have like that level of what they're doing with the
like
colors.
High contrast, cool tones.
Right.
Yeah, but at the same time, I understand they want the three miniseries to look consistent.
Yeah, I think
they
it's
just
kind of
kept going with it because that's what they've done.
It's an artistic choice. Another thing, the only other nitpick I have is I'm just sick in general of like movies or TV shows that have the flying CGI camera. And I know, especially in a show about like airplanes in the sky, you're going to have it, you know? And there's a lot of CGI in this show. But I just hate like the magical camera that could like fly in and out of like barriers and like go into any direction and scoot all around like a hummingbird. I don't know why. It's just bugging me. There's got to be, it's just in everything. That's the problem.
I think it also just feels outdated. It was super cool when you would like go to the IMAX theater, like one of those rounded dome theaters when you were a kid.
Yeah.
And they'd do that and make you feel like, oh, I'm going to crash into whatever. And like, that was like a big effect at the time. But now, like 30 whatever years later, we've seen it so many times that it's no longer novel. And you're like, all right, just like get on with the storytelling.
It's in everything. It's like you follow the bullets as they fly from the gun in slow motion. Or, you know, like, and just like all these dumb trick shots that I don't know how good they are. I mean, maybe they do kind of grip you in the moment at times, but in the great sum of things, it doesn't lend to me the feeling of like cool, great filmmaking of different eras where they couldn't do those things, so they had to like figure out another way to present something epic.
Right. I wonder even if like I can't really think of an example in modern times where it's like a CGI production and you're flying or whatever, and it doesn't do that. I wonder, like. Did no one do it, or did someone try it and they're like, well, this doesn't look good?
I don't know. It's just they want to, it's like an attention span thing. Like they want it to appear as exciting as possible at all times.
Yeah.
So the camera is just moving in a way that is like absurd and impossible. But, you know, I don't know. We've been watching like Cleopatra from the mid-60s, the Elizabeth Taylor movie, which at the time was the most expensive movie ever made. And the only reason I bring it up is just to mention, like, back then, for it to be the most expensive movie ever made, they were building sets so elaborate and large and finely detailed that...
A full Egyptian palace, a full, like, Roman forum.
Right, yeah, and scenes filled with 10,000 extras all in period costumes in the background, like, not even in focus.
Yeah.
And
we've talked about that a lot with, like, the Star Wars shows, that we wish they would do that instead of just, like, CGI-ing everything in.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it does look good. Yeah. I mean, the movie itself is pretty boring and slow, but,
yeah,
like,
the movie
look incredible.
The movie is not great. It's campy and silly. And it's literally 4 hours long, and we've just been watching in 20-minute chunks every night. But that's not the point. I love, like, to me, yeah, if I was making a mad, crazy movie, I would spend all the money on extras and, like, costumes and elaborate sets. Because it's, like, to capture that all for real on film versus you have some kind of, like fast-moving CGI shot over a city where it seems like it's populated, but if you paused it and zoomed in, everything's just like a computer blur.
Mm-hmm.
It's not real. And, I mean, we did compliment that Godzilla movie for... That was all CGI, that Tokyo.
Mm.
And it looked pretty good. The crowd stuff looked
good. Yeah.
So maybe they finally have some good assets now in the CGI machines that can, like, simulate, like, a crowd or, like, a crowded metro space better. But, in general, CGI is annoying. and before talking about Batman, we did mention we saw that
Sofia Coppola movie Priscilla.
Yeah, what did you think of that?
I really liked it. I didn't know really anything about Priscilla Presley. And you've gone on kind of like an Elvis streak lately.
Yeah.
Just getting into like different video footage of him and
right. I've been reading books about him. The funniest thing I saw was this hour-long infotainment thing on YouTube from 1984 where the real Priscilla Presley gives a guided tour through Graceland, which had been recently opened up as like a museum you could tour. And it's just like one of the funniest like nostalgia videos you could watch where she's in these incredible outfits and it's everything is presented as real glitzy and sparkly. And the stories about Elvis,
well, it is.
They like, you know, she tells these stories about Elvis that makes him seem like the greatest human being that ever lived. And she's like, and here's his karate gi collection.
Well, she has to. I mean, she inherited Graceland. She pronounces it Graceland,
right?
Not Graceland, but whatever. Anyway, so she inherited it. And it like the cost to upkeep it was like $1 million a year or something, like way more money than she had. So she ended up making it like this public space that people could come and visit.
Right.
So that she could just like keep it running. So it's like.
It was such a hit. It made all its money. It was in enormous debt. And like within 4 weeks of opening in his museum, it made all its money back.
Like kind of awesome. But I'm saying like this hour long video where she tells all these stories about what a great person Elvis was and how interesting.
Fly in the face of the Priscilla. Yeah. But it's interesting to see that the Priscilla movie is based on a book she wrote. She was an executive producer in the movie. So like, but on the one hand, she's like. Right there, like giving people as much Elvis propaganda as they want to the myth making, making him the king. And then on the other hand, it's like this movie that comes out makes Elvis look really bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's creepy. I mean, she was 14 when they met and then like
moved in when she was 16.
Moves her into Graceland. Yeah. And he controls every aspect of her life, like who she is and isn't allowed to like talk to, what she's allowed to wear.
Insisting that she remain a virgin until they get married.
Yeah, just it is crazy.
While he was sleeping with every woman, literally.
Like thousands of women on the side.
I thought it was a really good movie. It did, of course, I mean, Sofia Coppola, it did remind me of her Marie Antoinette movie. Mm. It's a similar premise in a way. Like a young, naive woman moves into a lavish palace and is just kind of like lives a life of like sort of frivolous luxury, but is trapped in a way.
Right.
In a gilded cage. So it's like a weird unofficial sequel to that. But it was great. I mean, it was really cool and fascinating. I think as someone who, if you're interested in Elvis, I think it's definitely worth watching too. But I think it's weird because I've like, I ended up watching a lot of interviews with the real Priscilla and she'll defend Elvis as well. So he was a loving man. He was actually really sweet and caring and kind. He did like have anger and temper problems occasionally, but it was only a few times. It was never that bad. And she excuses all like the like child bride grooming stuff, saying like, "Oh, I was older than my age, and I knew what I was doing." And I mean, it's like it is weird. It's like there's like a strange dichotomy between like her because she seems so like self possessed and intelligent. She's not like a dummy at all.
Because she like made it out of the marriage.
Yeah,
you know? Like she divorced him and became her own person.
But she talks about like
life and interests. But I'm sure that it's like it's both, you know.
Yeah.
And that's like why it's a compelling story.
Yeah, it is. I mean, she talks even with she says the divorce is really amicable. We stayed best friends. We loved our daughter together. You know, like there's nothing, no bad blood. Like it's just kind of like it is a very strange kind of story. And the Sofia Coppola movie leans into the stranger parts. More than like the ambivalent. What's the right word I'm looking for? The forgiving side that like the real Priscilla has told as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. That was cool. That was a cool movie to see.
Yeah.
I didn't know Elvis took LSD. That was a fascinating little subplot in the film.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty interesting to think that Elvis, that seemed like one of the last drugs he would ever want to try.
Right. And also that he gets into like these philosophical books.
He was like a hippie, not a hippie. He was just like of the times of like, there was a lot of 60s stuff going on that he like, got influenced by. But I don't know, you kind of do feel a little bad for Elvis in the sense of like he too was controlled in a way that was
by
beyond
like the music industry machine, whatever it was.
That's kind of I mean, you pointed it out. That, like, that's the lesson in the movie that he controls Priscilla because he himself
is controlled
and he wants one thing or a person to just control completely and have total say over. So I don't know, complex, sad too. The ending was weak.
Mm.
It ends very unexpectedly.
Very abruptly,
and it's not interesting, the ending. But all right, let us move on to Batman, Sonia. Past all our diversions here. This episode, the ultimate thrill. I don't know. That
was it?
I feel like they overpromised in the title. Bruce Timm called this episode, quote, probably the most blatantly risque episode we've ever done.
Yeah, I can see why.
I mean, for a children's cartoon, yes, but, like, in actuality, like, I didn't find it that risque.
There's, like, one very cringe scene at the end that was quite risque.
I guess, but I think that would fly over the heads of kids.
Yeah.
And even me as an adult, knowing it was coming and, like, experiencing it, it didn't even see. It seemed kind of stupid to me. It didn't seem, like,
that's
sexual.
That's why it's cringe. It was, like, stupid.
All right, Sonia, how does this episode start?
So we open up on Roxy Rocket. She's robbing some kind of, like, gathering, like, high society. They're in a blimp.
Seems like a real Gotham, like, gathering place, or blimps.
Yeah.
Blimps are a big, like, part of the Gotham culture.
In line with that, like, timelessness thing, right?
Yeah, the...
like, Zeppelin.
Art deco kind of world they live in.
So she, like, robs all these people of their jewels, and then she just jumps out of the blimp, and there's a police helicopter nearby, like, watching her fall, and they're like, oh, there's nothing we could do. She presses a button on her watch, and a rocket comes flying. It's, like, slightly larger than a human, I would say, the rocket. And she is able to just, like, ride it as if it were, like, a mechanical bull or something.
It's a lot like, it's kind of like the Green Goblin a little bit. And, you know, he flies around in that flying horseshoe
thing. No, that's like a wing.
I know, but
he stands on that with his 2 feet.
The original, in the comics, I think the original Green Goblin rocket was literally a rocket he rode between his legs.
Oh.
I might be mistaken there, but I have this memory of that image. And then they kind of, like, updated it over several comics to make it more of the wing we see.
Okay.
But it's, I mean, it's also like the broom of the Wicked Witch. A little bit. Like Harry Potter-esque, too, you know, updating it, like, magic, like, rocket brooms or something. This Roxy Rocket character, she comes from the, like, Bruce Timm was making comics at the time that are quite good, actually. The animated series comic adaptations are really good comic books with great art and very good stories. Hmm. I think Paul Dini was working on them, too, among other artists and writers. And, anyway, they introduced Roxy Rocket in the comics, and they liked her, and they said, let's put her in the cartoon as well. Hmm. So, you know, here she is. I guess not as popular as Harlequin, you know? It was just,
yeah, they try to make her, like, also kind of that timeless feel where they give her a lot of moxie, and she has a lot of these, like, one-liners, like, but it's all with sort of, like, a, I don't know what that, like, a mid-Atlantic accent almost.
She's like a mix between, like, an extreme 90s girl and a 1940s flying, you know, pilot ace from World War II as well. And she's dressed like that. She's got her, like, brown leather outfit on with her flying cap.
Yeah.
Over a shock of red hair. It just seems like a 90s character to me. I feel like there's a lot of those types of tropes going on in the 90s.
Yeah.
Like a weird mixture of, like, modern and vintage they were trying to, like, put together.
Right. And her backstory is that she used to be a stunt double on, like, movie sets.
Right.
For both men and women. And she got really addicted to, like, the adrenaline rush of risk-taking. And now it's like she's turned to her criminal ways, and no risk is big enough. She just keeps, like, upping the ante. And because of that, Batman finds out in a little bit here that no company would insure her anymore because she was, like, so crazy with the stunts she would do that, like, the movie industry had to kind of forsake her because they couldn't, like, take out insurance.
It just kind of seems, like, dumb because why is she dictating what stunts are to be done? Like, if there's uninsurable stunts, then the movie people could be like, we're just not doing the stunt. Like, you have to do this other stunt that's less dangerous.
Right, but they had to give her a motive to become a criminal.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's silly. It's an okay character. I mean, she feels like a... This just feels like a Jack Kirby, Stan Lee kind of character made in the 50s or 60s, a former stunt person that becomes a villain.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like there definitely are examples of that. Mysterio, not exactly. He was a special effects guy in movies.
Yeah.
But there definitely have to have been, like, former stunt guys that are superhero villains or... even maybe, like, minor superhero characters that enters the world of comics. So she's sort of in that line.
Right. So she's on this rocket, and the police helicopter starts shooting at her. She has a gun that shoots gas bombs, and she shoots it, like, right into the helicopter window. And then they have to have a crash landing, but they're okay.
I do think it was insane of the police to, like, they pull out their machine guns and just start shooting at her in the air. I found that a little over-aggressive.
Yeah, same.
You'd think that they'd want her to land safely. She's on a dangerous flying rocket in the city that could explode on people. Just seems kind of, you know, this seems more like a crazy woman than it does someone you got to shoot out of the sky for the sake of some rich people's jewelry.
Yes. But once she's dispatched the police, then Batman flies in his plane. And it's like she's been expecting him, like she was trying to lure him out almost. And
she has some corny dialogue that gives you an idea of what kind of character she is.
Uh-huh.
Fast plane, fast men, it's almost heaven. Let's burn. And it's just, I don't know, that strikes me as not great writing.
Yeah, I think that's the problem with most of her dialogue.
Yeah.
It strikes me as like not great writing. It's not something that a real person would say. A lot of it alludes to like the movies. She makes some kind of like pun about, you know.
She thinks she's in a movie.
Like she's acting like she's in a movie at certain times. And also she's like half in love with Batman.
Right.
And like it's hard to tell how serious she's being or if she's just kind of like making jokes with him.
Yeah, we'll get to that at the very end.
Yeah.
They finally like get to a summation of that feeling, and the way it ends is quite not good either.
Right. So Batman follows her into a tunnel in his plane, but like he has to bail out because part of it catches fire.
They're playing a game of chicken. They're like heading right at each other.
Right. So he has to go and like repair his plane, hopefully.
Thanks for a great first date. I'll call you.
Yeah. And she does like a little salute anytime when she's like leaving the scene of a crime or whatever.
Yeah. It's just like she's got this like dumb like post-feminism dialogue, right?
Yeah. She's a strong, independent woman.
But she's all about like sex and having fun. Like
I don't know. So Batman does manage an emergency landing in the Batcave.
That's a nice bit of animation.
Yeah, it's like a cool device he has in there, actually, that I don't know if we've seen before to like slow down the plane, even though it's broken.
It's got a bunch of like rubber wires that slow it down. And then that's where we learn who she is in the Batcave. Her real name is Roxanne Sutton. And we learned all about her the movie business background. Batgirl wonders if she's out for revenge as opposed to just getting the jewels.
Mm-hmm.
But Batman's like, the clue is going to be who she's fencing all these like jewels to. Because
right.
It's not going to be easy for her to find a buyer. And that's what leads us to a welcome cameo in this episode, the Penguin.
Right.
I like all this Penguin stuff.
It's like the Iceberg Lounge or something,
yeah.
Right, where he hangs out. So she brings the jewels that she robbed from the blimp to him there and, like, spreads them out on the table. He agrees to buy them from her. And she's like, all right, you know, she gets her two stacks of money. And she's like, double or nothing, highest card wins. And she's, like, trying to gamble with him.
She pulls out a deck of cards, and Penguin refuses to play. He's like, this isn't a movie, you know. I'm a legitimate businessman now. I don't want to draw attention to myself. I'm giving him a Cockney accent for some reason. I like this different like attitude from the Penguin. He's not quite a criminal anymore, but if he is, he wants to keep it very much on the down low.
He's trying to play it safe.
Right. It's just a totally different, it's almost like a totally different character, this Penguin.
Mm-hmm.
His hands are fixed. He no longer has flipper hands. We've talked about that the last time we saw him.
Yeah. So their interaction is finished and, she leaves and she's like, all right, you're lost. Cut to Lucius Fox at Wayne Industries unveiling like this fancy modern painting that Bruce has bought. And Bruce is worried about security, rightly so, because Roxy Rocket comes flying in through the window and robs the painting right away.
She also has this flare gun that she shoots into the sky, that makes a firework bat display. She's trying to lure Batman directly. She wants the challenge of dealing with him or the thrill of facing him.
And it works. He shows up with his jetpack on.
The bat jetpack.
The bat pack.
And they're like flying around chasing each other. And this whole time I'm thinking, this seems like a job for Superman.
True. She flies into she's on her rocket again, obviously. Right. She flies into a grate over like a tunnel and shoots at Batman with like another flare gun. He has to dodge traffic. He's like in the tunnel, like scraping up his backpack rocket thing. He throws a batarang at her and it shorts out her rocket. So she has to do a crash landing at a construction site. And she like takes the painting and climbs up like super tall scaffolding with it. And she's like luring Batman up there. And then she throws the painting over the edge and Batman has to like jump to catch it. And then he's just hanging on by like a couple fingers.
It's kind of funny that Batman risks his life to catch this painting.
Yeah. I know. I really thought he was going to just like let it fall and go after her.
Yeah. Seems kind of silly, but it was a big invent. I mean, he personally did buy it.
Right. But if he has to keep up the illusion that he isn't Bruce Wayne, wouldn't it make more sense to like not show attachment I don't know.
I don't know either. I mean, I guess the painting has some kind of intrinsic worth, or it feels like it's a cultural artifact that needs to be.
Yeah. Anyway, she like signals to her rocket to explode because she had like left it at the bottom of the construction site.
He's like another Green Goblin stunt.
Yeah. And like as it's coming up to explode at Batman, she like jumps over the side. There's like a little inflatable.
It's like a blimp at the construction site, I guess, in case people might fall. That was my only rationale for like why this blimp is there. Not a blimp. It's
It's like one of those bouncy house balloons or something.
It is. It's because it's shaped like a rocket. But I think the logical explanation is it must have just been like a safety feature of the construction site.
I don't know. She falls onto it like gracefully and like swings her way out of there. And she makes her getaway looking like a stunt woman, basically.
Batgirl then informs Batman. She figures out who the fence is. It's Penguin. And he's like, can you trust your sources? And this was a weird shot where they cut.
This was like an unnecessary scene.
I didn't understand what was going on here.
Batman's like, do you trust your sources on this information? Or like, are your sources good is what he says. Mm. And Batgirl says, well, I don't know if you'd call them good, but I trust them. And then it cuts over. I thought they were supposed to be prostitutes.
Yeah, what? Maybe that's what it is. Yeah, you might be right. Maybe that's what Bruce Timm was alluding to, is this being the most risque episode.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
But it did seem unnecessary.
Yeah, there's just these two like scantily clad women standing near Batgirl. She's vouching for them being sources.
So Penguin is mad at Roxy because he feels like she shouldn't be targeting Batman this directly. It's going to draw suspicion. And eventually, you know, like Batman's going to find out that he's the one buying all the jewels and stuff. He's behind it. And so he's setting up to shoot her with his umbrella. And when she realizes that he's turned against her, she like kicks the umbrella out of his hands and
she falls backwards in his pool that currently has a bunch of killer seals living in it.
Yeah, I don't know why.
These seals, they've got like vicious teeth and they look real hungry and mad.
I don't think seals are aggressive towards humans.
Who knows? I mean, maybe penguins like torturing them or raising them a certain way. I mean, who knows? But I like the scene. It was pretty cool. Like the danger of the penguin just outright murdering this woman now, or attempting to anyway.
She emerges from the water riding one of the seals.
Yeah, that was funny. I like that. That was my favorite part.
Almost like it was her rocket.
Yeah.
Penguin starts shooting at her. She grapples away. There's like a whole altercation between them.
She gets out of there. But then Penguin informs what at first he just assumed to be the waitresses at the Iceberg Lounge, but turns out to be his muscle. These like scantily clad women in like
leotard outfits.
Playboy bunny outfits.
Yeah.
And he's like, I want her clipped permanently. And it turns, you know, they're the ones who are going to go do the dirty work for Penguin.
Later that night, Penguin is shaving in the bathroom.
He's doing something in the bathroom.
Something in the mirror of the bathroom, and Batman appears behind him. And he, like, manages to get hold of one of his machine guns, and he, like, ends up shooting up his whole apartment.
It's pretty cool the way he destroys his own apartment with his gun. But meanwhile, every time Batman gets a chance, he's just flinging the Penguin around and menacing him.
He, like, gets him by the collar and holds him over the edge of his own, of Penguin's balcony.
Let's say we have a little talk, just like old times. It's pretty violent for the animated series.
Yeah, and it works. I mean, you know, Penguin ends up telling him everything because his slipper falls off the side of the building to its death 100 stories down.
I mean, Penguin exists in so many different media to be manhandled by Batman and to force to give up information.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I think of the Matt Reeves movie. That was like a famous scene of that happening.
Right. Meanwhile, Penguin's goons, these ladies still in their like Playboy bunny outfits, go and spy on Roxy, and she they're not slick at it at all. She sees them, and she's working on like fixing one of her rockets. She has a wrench and stuff.
She has two rockets, by the way, which is
right.
Important to note.
Or maybe even more, who knows?
Right.
But she beats them up easily.
Yeah, she knows karate. She also has like a big wrench and beats another one down, and she kicks two of them into a plane that's on the runway, and she makes the plane take off with them in it so that they might go flying off or crash and die.
It ends up crashing into a water tower before it leaves the ground.
Right.
And
they're fine.
They're just like, they're fine. They're just out of control.
That was the second instance in this episode where people had a horrible crash but survived inexplicably. Like earlier when she gets the the police helicopter to crash, it literally crashes into a building and explodes, but you see the cops like flung out in front of the copter being okay.
Yeah, you know, yeah. For kids.
Right.
So Batman arrives in the Batmobile, and Roxy takes off on her newly fixed rocket. Batman uses the spare rocket to catch up to her. They're flying into the Gotham Canyon.
Yeah. We've always talked about Gotham as like Springfield from The Simpsons. It's surrounded by a desert, a beach.
It has every landscape that you might need.
Right, mountains, forests, everything. Yeah. And then we also discovered in one of the episodes that Gotham City literally is New York City.
Right.
I forget the exact like reasoning, but it was like made abundantly clear that it is New York in one of the episodes. So The famous canyons right outside New York City. Desert canyons.
He's chasing her on a rocket. She shoots him. She has like a lightning gun or something.
Oh yeah, she pulls out this cool little like ray pistol, like a 1950s ray gun.
Uh-huh.
And it shoots the lightning and almost kills him.
He grapples onto one of the wings of her rocket, and she like drags him through a forest. He emerges unscathed.
Although it looks like it's painful for him.
Yes, it does. But when they come out, he's sitting on the back of the rocket behind her somehow. She takes off her jacket and they're like, she turns around. She puts it on autopilot so she can turn around and face him. They're like looking at each other.
She's in a black leotard now. She's pretty sexy.
Yeah, it's like a tank top or something.
Right.
And she says like, all right, like you got to jump into the water. Otherwise we're going to die. And Batman just crosses his arms and refuses to budge.
And then she's like, she finally loses her nerve and is going to press a button. The rock of a Batman stops her and makes her just like live with the fated choice of doing nothing as they're about to crash and die. And she actually starts getting off on it. She's like, oh, this is the ultimate thrill. The final stunt that I've been waiting for my whole life. And as they're sort of like crashing, she starts moaning and sort of like sexually gyrating orgasmically.
Very uncomfortable.
Right. So this is the moment Tim, what's his name? Bruce Timm was talking about.
That it's like the most explicit.
Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, she thinks they're about to die, but, you know, they're like sort of falling in the sky now. But Batman has a parachute in his cape.
And he like parachutes them to safety. I don't know why the scene had to be explicit in this way. They could have just, I mean, they made it pretty clear that she was insane.
Right.
They didn't have to like make it sexual at all.
I don't think it's necessarily sexual towards him. It's just sexual in general.
Exactly. Like, why did it have to be sexual in general? I don't know.
It's weird. Anyway, she's, like, surprised. So after they land, she thinks it's all, like, been a gas and thinks that, like, Batman, like, must have gotten off on this, too.
She's like, oh, I get it. Live to play another game or something like that. She keeps thinking that she, like, understands whatever Batman's angle is.
Right.
Then she never does.
She's very confused about, like, what is she even doing? Like, and Batman mentions that earlier, too, that she doesn't may not even, like, be doing this for any reason other than just the thrill.
Mm-hmm. And that comes to bear.
Right. She doesn't care about crime. Like, the consequences, none of that matter. So yeah.
He puts the bat handcuffs on her as the police show up. And she's very surprised at this turn of events. He says, this is my kind of game, and you lost.
And she's super sad in the last shot. Like, the reality hits her. Like a ton of bricks, and that's how the episode ends. So Batman was not sexually interested in you, Roxy.
Surprise.
I mean, in some weird way, you'd think like a guy like Bruce Wayne or Batman might be tempted by a woman like this. She's fearless like him.
I mean, it also wouldn't be unprecedented. He's had like an on again, off again relationship with Catwoman.
Yeah, they're the same kind of criminal. They're sort of like the petty burglars. Well, or high society burglars, anyway. And, yeah, I mean, like, she's hot. Like, they could have...
But her personality.
Yeah, personality sucks. But they could have, again, they could have... That's why the writing was bad, because they could have pumped a little more into the script of just, like, introducing that temptation to Batman.
Mm-hmm.
And having have to, like, maybe have doubt himself and... Or feel something. I mean, he never has the moment like he does with so many villains where he's like, Roxy, you don't have to do it.
Yeah. Just give it up.
Just give it up or you're going to die. Like, he never really gets to that level of empathy.
He doesn't have, like, that much dialogue in this episode, actually. Mm. A lot of it, he's just, like, staring at her silently.
He's, like, surprisingly calm in a lot of this episode. Outside of him, like, violently manhandling the Penguin.
This episode was probably like a 5 out of 10 for me. I did not like this character.
I'm going to give it a 4. I think it's a pretty bad episode.
Yeah.
I mean, is it all bad? I do like seeing the Penguin. I thought that was, I think this new version of the Penguin's a lot of fun. I liked a lot of his character choices in this episode. Mm-hmm. The Roxy character is just like a miss of a, it reminds me, didn't they have a Spider-Man episode with a kid on a like a rocket skateboard that really sucked that we talked about?
Yeah. You know, this is bad for different reasons.
Right.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe in the comics, the character was really cool when she was introduced. I just like
didn't
translate well to this iteration for whatever reason.
And the risque stuff didn't titillate. It didn't like make me feel anything. Or
it was just uncomfortable.
I wouldn't even say it was uncomfortable. I'd say it was just boring. It was like not even. It didn't like do anything for me. So whatever. I mean, they're not all going to be winners. Again, it's not. It's still perfectly watchable.
That's the thing. Yeah, it's not like I was so bored that I had to like turn it off.
Or, no,
like it's not like it was a struggle to watch. Maybe it's because I hadn't seen it before, so I.
Yeah,
you know, it maintains your curiosity of well, what is going to happen here?
The animation and action's always great. Like, I mean, there's a lot of scenes in the episode that like just grab your attention. You're like, oh, cool. You know, so it's not like it's. They didn't put effort into the presentation of it. Mm-hmm. It's just a weak script.
I wouldn't revisit this one, though.
No, me neither. It's a one and done.
One and done.
Sonia, until next week.
Good night.
Good night.